It's Weekend Edition here on 90.1 WABE. I'm Jim Burris. It's easy to understand why Coke is so integral to the fabric of Atlanta. Almost since John Pemberton mixed the first batches in the mid-1880s, it's really been an institution here, but its cult status extends globally, and the Coke story is much broader than a simple, cheap soft drink. Mark Pendergrass wrote the book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola, first published in 1993. The third edition was recently released, and he joins me now from his home in Vermont via Skype. Mark, welcome.
Thanks.
So what's new in the Coke storyline that warrants this third edition?
A lot. The second edition came out in 2000, at which point the company was beginning to have major problems. Roberto Gazueta had died in 1987. The soda peaked, really, the per capita consumption in the United States in 1998. So they had come out with Dasani, the water, in 1989, but Doug Ivester was in big trouble for various reasons and had just been ousted when my last edition came out. So a lot has happened. The company went through a dreadful time under CEO Doug Daft from 2000 to 2004, during which thousands of people were fired. The SEC and the FBI were probing the company for various problems. There was a racial class action discrimination suit against the company. There were whistleblowers. It was really a mess. And the obesity epidemic was being laid directly at the feet of Coca-Cola. So Daft left in 2004 saying that basically if he had stayed, he would have probably died. I mean, he really was stressed. They brought back Neville Isdell, thank God, and he turned the company around, really. He restored morale. He began to basically settled the lawsuit and settled all of the problems that were really facing the company in a huge way. And he began to reposition the company as hopefully part of the solution to the obesity epidemic by increasing the number of exercise programs that the company was sponsoring. He also focused on safe water issues, which I think is very important around the world to try to provide clean water for people, which is something that's dear to my heart because of my previous book about the CDC that I'd written. And they also began to try to help with AIDS in Africa. So, and then he brought Muhtar Kent back into the company and sort of groomed him as his CEO. And Kent has done a remarkable job and continued the trajectory of sort of upward development. That's not to say that there are not still a lot of problems. They're still certainly being blamed a lot for the obesity epidemic. But there's a lot to update in the story.
The Coke company has really faced kind of challenges through its entire existence. Is that as much a part of the mystique and the Coke story as its success?
You know, I think that the Coke story is absolutely amazing. It has all of these huge dramas throughout the history. From the very beginning, it was a controversial drink because originally it had a little bit of cocaine in it because it was made from fluid extract of coca leaf. They took that out in 1903 without making a big deal about it because they didn't really want to talk about that it was there in the first place. And if you go to the Coke Museum to this day, they'll tell you, oh, no, it never had cocaine in it, which is absurd. It did. The United States government sued Coca-Cola in 1911 after the cocaine had been taken out because they didn't like children drinking caffeine, among other things. And the company barely survived. Since then, they've never shown children under the age of 12 drinking Coca-Cola in their ads. They had to find other ways to appeal to children. The other thing I didn't talk about, by the way, was Coca-Cola was basically forced at gunpoint to take its sugary soft drinks out of schools a few years ago. It was, quote, voluntary, but if they hadn't done it, it would have been a disaster. So anyway, there are so many things to talk about in terms of Coca-Cola's remarkable history. And you're right. It's always been an up and down. I mean, I think, I have a whole chapter on the Coca-Cola flavor change from 1985, which I call the marketing blunder of the century. There's a whole chapter on Coca-Cola during World War II, when at government expense, they sent Coca-Cola men dressed in army uniforms overseas to start 64 bottling plants behind the lines. At the same time, the head of Coca-Cola inside Nazi Germany was keeping the company going there and created Fanta. I mean, it's just mind-boggling, all of the stuff that's in this story.
It really is. And, throughout the story, you keep coming back to this idea that really what we're talking here is no more than cheap sugar water. So what is it about this cheap sugar water that people forget that aspect and put it on par with God and with country?
Well, it is ironic to me. Coca-Cola is a non-essential product. We would all live if we couldn't get it. It's not just, I do say it's 99% sugar water, and that's true, but it's actually a very interesting formula. John Pemberton was, it turns out, a morphine addict who was particularly interested in coca leaf and cocaine because he thought it was a harmless way to get off of his addiction. But he also, it was the beginning of international commerce when you had steamships and railroads. So he had ingredients from Peru, that was the coca leaf, from Ghana, that was the kola nut, cassia, oil of cassia, which is Chinese cinnamon, comes from China. There were ingredients from all over the world, and it's quite a fascinating formula, which, by the way, I have a new version of it in this book, which I think is fabulous. It's a facsimile written in the hand of Frank Robinson, who is the sort of unsung hero of Coca-Cola, who named the drink back in 1886, who wrote out the familiar script that we all know so well that says Coca-Cola in his handwriting. And who advertised it and who manufactured it. So I managed to get this recipe from his great-granddaughter a few years ago and I have put it in the book. So that's causing a bit of a furor currently.
And in fact, though, you relay the story of a company spokesman who hands you the Coke formula and says, hey, now what are you going to do with that?
Well, he didn't actually hand, he pretended to hand me the formula. was a joke.
Right, but the idea is that, okay, so even if you get this, so what? Now what would you do with it? And this stopped you in your tracks.
I did not want to hurt the company. I had gotten hold of a Coke formula. And I said, well, what if I put the formula in my book? And he said, basically, we don't care. Because if somebody made this, they couldn't call it Coca-Cola. We already have the world's best distribution system. We have spent well over 100 years building the brand equity of this product. It's incredibly well advertised. Why would anybody go out of their way to buy a fake Coca-Cola that would inevitably cost more, that would not be easy to find because it wouldn't be well distributed, when they can get it anywhere, they can get the real thing anywhere in the world cheaper? And he was right. So they don't really care who has their formula. The important thing about the formula is the mystique of it and the fact that it gets a lot of attention. And they're delighted with that. That's why they were really smart when they moved the secret formula to the vault inside the World of Coca-Cola Museum, which if people haven't gone to see it, even in Atlanta, you really ought to go over there. It's hysterical. I mean, they've really done it up. It's terribly dramatic. I made a little YouTube out of it. If you go and Google Mark Pendergrass Coca-Cola Vault on YouTube, you'll see what they've done. It's very clever.
Yeah, I actually took my mom there this year when she came to visit, and it was over the top but interesting at the same time.
Exactly. And they have all these little mathematical formula swirling around the floor that are completely irrelevant to how you make Coca-Cola, but it's fun.
Sure. I want to ask you about the title, because On the surface, it might seem like your use of God is hyperbole, but you actually make the argument that Coke really isn't that far off from a religion. Why is that?
Well, it certainly was a religion to Asa Candler, who was the first head of Coca-Cola who made a lot of money out of it. John Pemberton died 2 years after inventing it. Candler used to lead his sales force in singing Onward Christian Soldiers. His brother was the Methodist bishop, Warren Candler, who was very much involved with, you know, carrying Coca-Cola with him on missionary work to Cuba. So, you know, there's been it's a long-standing joke within Coca-Cola that if you become a Coca-Cola employee, that you have a transfusion so that you don't have blood in your veins, you have Coca-Cola syrup flowing. That's, I say at the end of the book, that's not so true anymore, which I think is a shame. The company, you know, it's turning into just another American corporation where this is a place where you go for a few years and it's a stepping stone to other places in your career. It's being run by MBAs, et cetera. But still, it seems to be more of a company that where you're imbued with the Coca-Cola religion from the time that you begin to work there, more so than in other companies. So within the company, it's a religion. But even for consumers, it's so much a part of our lives from the time we are very young, so that when they changed the flavor in 1985, you had people writing to them basically saying, you know, this is like killing God. You can't do this. It's like, you know, taking the most meaningful thing in my life away from me, which was ridiculous. But it's how people reacted. So, yeah, I mean, Coca-Cola was used during the Battle of the Bulge instead of sacramental wine. So it literally was part of a liturgy. I argue in the book also that, you know, people want, what does religion do for you? Religion makes you part of a meaningful community where people believe in the same thing. And in lots of ways, that's what the best Coca-Cola advertising has done, like the Hilltop commercial where, you know, it's a religious commercial. There are all these young people standing very seriously holding Coca-Cola like a talisman of peace and singing, you know, I'd like to teach the world to sing. I mean, it's heartwarming. A lot of their ads have been, the best ads have been heartwarming. So I would argue that in a way it is a religion, yes.
You say that the company has changed and it's not quite the religion maybe it used to be, at least internally. Where do you see Coca-Cola as a company going?
It's a very good question. I mean, somebody in my book said that, you know, this company is destined to outlast the United States. It's more self-correcting than the Roman Empire. That may be true, you know. I mean, certainly they're having to readjust massively in the last 10 years. They're diversifying much more than they ever have before. They spent $4.1 billion buying Glasso so they could get hold of vitamin water. They now offer 3,500 different drinks around the world, and about a quarter of them are low-calorie or no-calorie drinks. And it wouldn't surprise me in the next decade if the combined sales of Coke Zero, which is another thing that, by the way, included in this update, and Diet Coke surpassed regular Coca-Cola. So it's a different world out there where they're having to acknowledge the fact that many, many consumers are beginning to turn away from sugar-laden or high-fructose corn syrup-laden Coke. But I think that they are going to do incredibly well. I mean, Muhtar Kent talks about a 2020 vision that by the year 2020, the company will have doubled its sales, and they're well on their way to doing that. Stop and think about it. Coca-Cola is the world's most widely distributed single consumer product. It's in every country in the world except North Korea and Cuba legally. And, of course, you can buy it in those countries, too, on the black market. So it's just an extraordinary story of what has been accomplished in really 126 years at this point, not that long in human history. So in another 126 years, who knows? I mean, you don't know. Maybe the company will go bankrupt. Maybe we'll look back on Coca-Cola the same way we look back at Van Mariani now, which is what really inspired Coca-Cola indirectly. There was this very famous drink called Van Mariani. And nobody remembers it now, but it was world famous at the time that Pemberton was inventing his drinks.
Do you think that a new drink that rivals Coke in popularity can emerge in kind of in this climate we're in right now?
I think it would be very difficult to do that because, you know, the marketing people talk about first mover status. Coca-Cola was the first cola drink, and it spawned a huge number of imitators, including Pepsi, in the late 19th century and early 20th century. At this point, I think it would be very difficult for another cola drink to come out. And there's such diversity in all the different drinks that are out there, including, you know, energy drinks and pseudo health drinks and who knows what else that's out there now. It's difficult to conceive that one of them could establish the incredible level and depth of meaning that Coca-Cola has been able to do.
Do you drink Coke?
I do drink Coca-Cola, particularly on really hot summer days when when I've been exercising and it's just really, and there's nothing more thirst quenching than an ice cold Coca-Cola with shaved ice on a hot summer day. Other than that, I don't actually drink a whole lot of any soda. And the fact of the matter is I prefer Sprite to Coca-Cola most of the time, unless I've really had a lot of exercise.
I think as long as you're purchasing anything in their portfolio, they're okay with that.
I would not drink Pepsi.
Really? Why?
Hey, I grew up in Atlanta. I've spent the last 20 years following Coca-Cola also. Why would I drink Pepsi?
That actually leads into my next question. You've been working on this for more than 20 years. This is an absolute comprehensive history as they come. Do you feel that Coke is really a part of your life in ways that nothing else is?
Oh, God. Do you think I have it flowing in my veins, too? I don't think so. I mean, you know, it's a fascinating history. It's an interesting company. It's involved with politics and culture and health and everything you can imagine in the world. So, but I'm more interested in it because of all of its ramifications than in the same way that, you know, fanatical Coke collectors or drinkers are.
A lot of people in recent history kind of equate Coca-Cola with issues of water availability, especially in third world countries. And, you know, this is an image problem or has been an image problem for Coke. Do you think that this is going to be something they continue to fight, or is that in Coke's history as well?
Well, I think they're still dealing with it, particularly in India. Coca-Cola was accused of depleting the water table, and India does have terrible problems with its water. And I wrote about that at some length in this new edition. I don't think Coke can really be blamed for India's water problems. 98% of that comes from their poor agricultural use of water. They use pesticides very extensively so that almost everything that you drink in India has pesticide in it. Coke has less than any other product that I know of, although it probably still does have a minuscule amount of it in it. Coke has gone out of its way to try to do rainwater harvesting to replenish the water table in India. The trouble is, if it doesn't rain, you can't. Rainwater harvesting doesn't help. And I do fault the company for some of the placement of their plants, which they built in very drought-stricken areas. And it does appear that some of what they've done has helped to deplete the water table. They've gone out of their way to try to also keep the water that they dispose of so that to make it so that at least a fish can live in it, you know, so that not necessarily potable, but it's not horribly polluted. And they're well on their way to having succeeded in doing that. The good thing about Cook also is wherever they are, if there is a disaster, a tsunami, a flood, an earthquake, they can provide clean water to people, and they often do, and really don't get recognized for the relief that they offer. And they bring clean water technology wherever they go. I thought you were also complaining about bottled water, which has been widely vilified. You know, people point out that Dasani is really just municipal water that's been treated, which is true. On the other hand, wherever you can find Coca-Cola products anywhere in the world, they're not going to make you sick. And, some 2 million children die every year from drinking polluted water. Let's not forget that.
Sure. Well, Mark, we've touched on everything I had kind of bullet pointed. Was there something you wanted to talk about that we didn't?
Yeah, we didn't talk about the accusations about Coca-Cola being involved in human rights violations, torture and murder and things like that, particularly in Colombia. There's an organization called Killer Coke. There's an organization called Killer Coke that has been hammering at the company for years about this. And there was a lawsuit was launched here in the United States. Basically, the story was that in the 1990s, a series of union workers at Coca-Cola bottling plants were murdered. And it's not too surprising because paramilitary groups in Colombia were murdering lots of union employees. The question is whether the bottlers were involved, and the question was whether Coca-Cola could have done more to stop it. So that's been a very large issue. And there are other things that have happened more recently in Guatemala that I wrote about also. So people who are interested in criticism of the company will certainly find, I tried to be very fair and balanced in my book, and I think I was. But I certainly included all the warts as well as all the good things. I also talked about things like, the happiness ambassadors. They sent these three they sent these 20-year-olds around the world. They were supposed to go during 2010 to every country that Coke was in at the time. That was 206. They didn't quite make it to all of them because of revolutions and danger and things like that. But they made it to most of them. But it was, this is part of their brilliant new marketing strategy, which is to involve consumers interactively where they can, post things on Facebook pages. Their new advertising mantra is to be liquid and linked, to get their consumers to be part of the action. Sure. And so, I think their Open Happiness campaign has been one of the most successful that they've had. It was certainly the ones before Open Happiness weren't that good since the Always Coca-Cola campaign. So I talk a great deal about their advertising strategies as well.
Great. Well, Mark Pendergrass wrote the book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. The third edition is now on bookstore shelves. Mark, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.